second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus William Marshall, Gene P. Smith, and Dennis K. Marshall. For the appellants, Mr. David Hosmer, an attorney from Yankton, and for the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Robert E. Mayer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Hosmer, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the Honorable Court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the South Dakota Supreme Court, counsel, I would first of all like to thank you, although you didn't come to see me. I'm from Yankton, and thank you very much for coming. William Michelle, or Bill, Dennis Michelle, and Gene Smith hired me to represent them regarding this appeal and to ask for your assistance. I strongly believe they received an unfair trial, and as a result, they would request that you reverse the judgments of conviction and order a new trial. The brief and appellant's brief set forth 10 unique arguments, which I believe are in the program for the benefit of the audience. Each is unique, some more than others, and I would like to set forth just a few facts to give a little flavor for where we're at. Bill is Dennis's father. Gene is a friend from Minnesota. Each is a nature lover, an avid hunter. Bill owns real property in Minor County, a small county in South Dakota, Howard, the location of the county seat, and each year during the pheasant seasons and deer seasons, they enjoy the company of friends and occasionally some paid hunters to come in for pheasants and deer. The events of this case actually stem from an undercover work of two agents hired by the State of South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks to infiltrate Bill's pheasant and deer hunts in 1999 and 2000. Without going into detail, and I think it's alluded to by the state and myself, this was not the first time that the GFP and my clients had met. The agents were very cordial. They came in, they hunted, it appeared that they had a good time, they got some pheasants, they had some deer, but then they reported back, and eventually charges were brought. And the charges, which were 27, 25 of which were eventually found by a jury to have been actually occurred. They range from everything: possession of pheasants, use of electronic equipment to hunt, protrusion of a firearm from a vehicle, discharging a firearm from a right-of-way, leading a hunt with more than 20 hunters, using a vehicle to disturb game, and transporting untagged deer. Although it's not the sexiest of issues, I think the most important issue that this court should resolve is the separation of powers argument, because it has the potential to cause major, I think, shifts in power in the state of South Dakota between the branches of government. Now, issue number one, which is the separation of powers argument, really pertains to 15 of the 25 counts, so it is the vast majority of a lot of the arguments for those particular cases.
So if you prevail on those charges, there would be no retrial because there's no crime, correct?
Absolutely. I think the Lyrla case establishes that if there is no crime, there is no jurisdiction, and it's done for those 15 counts. So it's only the other counts which we would seek a new trial for. For example, the improper instruction, etc. I'd like to just give a little flavor for what we've actually gone through and how we got to the separation of powers argument today. Just a little flavor. By 1889, when the South Dakota Constitution was enacted, 100 years had passed since the enactment of the United States Constitution. There had been very little discussion at the federal level about the federal separation of powers between the three branches of government. However, political theory at the time assumed that the separation of powers doctrine was a substantive protection of liberty. This is not just something that a bunch of people came together and said, let's do it. They actually thought that it protected the liberty of the individual. I would coin it as structural liberty. In that sense,
there are transcripts of the constitutional debates of 1885 and 1889 that preceded our Constitution and resulted in it. Can you point to anything in those debates that supports
I actually tried reading through it. My grandfather has a multi-set very large, in fact. It's very detailed. Unfortunately, I could not find any actual quotations which were taken by the secretary at the time. But I do believe it is important, and I'll tell you why. Because our separation of powers is expressed, whereas the federal separation of powers is merely implied. The significance is that if you have an express provision of the Constitution, that simply means that the citizens voted on it. And if I went back and looked correctly, in 1889, the vote was 95.5% in favor of passing the Constitution and 4.5% against it. So that means the citizens of then Dakota Territory had the opportunity to look at it and make a decision and said, yes, we want the structure of the three actual divisions of power. You know, and this is not something that had just arisen. And I quote from Montesquieu, who is a great political writer, quote, "There can be no liberty where the legislative and executive powers are united in the same person. Or, if the power of judging be not separated from the legislature and executive powers." And he described it as the mirror of political liberty. Well, that's very powerful. When you talk about structural liberty and say that it is actual political liberty, it's very important. And that's why I think it's the most important issue. Now, obviously, he did not believe in absolute separation. Let's face it, there are some instances where just things occur. For example, checks and balances is an obvious example of where you actually have some commingling of powers or trumping of other powers of other governments. The key to that as well, though, is this. Those are expressed. They're expressly provided in the Constitution. And in fact, Madison also, James Madison, author of Federalist No. 47, relied upon Montesquieu. And it was merely a question of the proper balance. Madison noted that too much power in one branch of government, quote, is the very definition of tyranny. I'm here to argue that we have had a slow accretion of power in the executive branch for years. For years, the legislature has abdicated its responsibility and said, go ahead, executive branch. Do what you want to do. We're just going to give you, in some instances, good guidance. In some instances, no guidance. And it's time to restore the balance back to, rightfully, the legislative branch of the South Dakota government. Now, the significance of, like I said, is the express provision. And I've looked to specifically the heading of Article 2, where it says, quote, the powers of the government of the state are divided into three distinct departments. Notice the key word. Article 3, Section 1 expressly provides, quote, the legislative power of the state shall be vested in the legislature, unquote. And obviously that begs the question, what is power? I teach a course in Mount Marty, and I always tell students, if you're going to think about power, think of it as a pie chart. And the pie chart is constantly changing. You might have the executive branch getting a little bit more power one year. You might have the individual having a part of the power of government to make a decision. Because occasionally the Bill of Rights trumps the majority. Well, in my opinion, the power chart has slowly been leading away from the legislature to the executive branch. We're basically being ruled by administrative rules to a large extent in life.
Standards, as long as the legislature expresses its policy. So the devil's in the details. I don't think anyone would argue with most of what you've said already about this. The details of this case, whether there were sufficient standards for the Game and Fish Department to add.
With all due respect, Justice Department, I would disagree, and I'll tell you why. There has to be something that's so important that you can't delegate. The Boe versus Foss case in 1956 specifically said that there are some essential powers that you can't transfer. You can't give them up. I would contend that if it's written into the Constitution, you can't do it. For example, could the legislature delegate to a commission in another branch the power to veto an executive, or pardon me, the power to override a veto? Absolutely not.
That's an easy question, you know.
Absolutely.
The question today is, can they delegate powers of the Game and Fish Department to decide whether you can have 19 hunters in a group or 20 hunters in a group. And those are the kinds of details that are involved in the crimes with which you're applying search warrants.
That's true. That is true, but you have to go back to the base. I mean, because frankly, when you're talking about separation of powers, a lot of it is philosophy. What we're really deciding is whether or not the legislature can give up and abdicate its responsibility to create the essential elements of a crime. That's it. Because if they can, I can create all kinds of scenarios. What if the legislature decided in its wisdom that that the Department of Health knew more about the actual trimesters of abortion and said, let's give it to the Department of Health to create a partial birth abortion bill, and they can pass it to administrative rules and regulate it for each one of the hospitals in the state. Now, let's face it, if they create an administrative rule that punishes doctors or pregnant women for actually having an abortion or not having an abortion, whatever the case may be, that means that they're actually permitting a crime to be defined by the administrative body. The Bolt versus Foss case says that they have to be quasi-legislative. The creation of a crime, a criminal statute, concerning acts and omissions is not quasi-legislative. It is the definition of legislative. It is essential. If you're going to deprive a person potentially of their liberty, let's at least have a committee meeting on it. Let's at least have a legislative body debate it. Now, if the GFP can create elements of crimes, then the legislature has basically said, we're not going to take the time because it's not important enough. And you know, that's wrong. That is wrong. That is giving away the responsibility that they have to do that. I point out, for example, to Statute 22-1-8, which was enacted in 1939, which specifically says this, quote, no act or omission shall be deemed criminal or punishable except as prescribed or authorized by this title or by some other statute of this state, unquote. Now, the way I read that is this. The only crimes that you can have to be statutory. They have to be statutory. Now, keep this in mind as well. The legislature may define the improper act or omission under that statute. They may ultimately lead to a person losing their liberty. Obviously, in 1939 at least, the executive branch admitted it, that they don't have the authority to create any type of crime. The bill was signed. So, because Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution requires the governor to sign all bills, looks to me like the executive branch admits they can't create crimes, and that's exactly what they've been doing. 15 of the charges against my clients were administrative rules.
Well, the complaint says ARSP,
that's exactly what the complaint said, the indictment. It was a superseding indictment, and it quoted to the original rulemaking statute, 42.118, I believe, and it cited to the administrative rule. Now, look, obviously, I can go look at 42.118, and I've looked at it. It basically says general policies, things like this. The GFP is responsible for maintaining all of the wildlife in the state of South Dakota for the protection of all of its citizens. Now, I do not want to get into the argument about whether or not it's sufficiently defined for discretion, because that argument was not made at the lower level, and I don't think that it's been preserved. But I certainly think it was preserved for the issue of whether or not they have the authority to do it in the first place as it relates to the creation of crimes. Now, I think it's important that the court also know what the other case law in this area has been. For example, the State versus Johnson case. This court said that it was a violation of separation of powers for the legislature to create a penal statute in which other elements were created or referred to in there and were to be gleaned from other sources. In that case, they had decided that LSD was going to be improper against the law. But they didn't name it in the statute. They just said, whatever the federal government says is illegal, go ahead and use those definitions of controlled substances which are prohibited. The court said, no, that's totally inappropriate. You can't make a penal statute such as that rely upon what somebody else says. You, the legislature, have to decide the penal statutes. Now, I know that the state is going to argue that South Dakota migratory bird case has some bearing upon this case. And I would say this, it's close, but they struck out in the ninth inning on their argument. They're not gonna win. I've read the South Dakota migratory case up and down 5 times. It says nothing about permitting the Game and Fish Department to create criminal statutes. That was a declaratory judgment action in which this court said that the Game Fish Parks had the authority to create a rule which said you can't use lead shot. That's all it said. There was no issue decided on whether or not it's a violation of separation of powers to delegate the authority to create a criminal statute. It just does not exist. So I think both of those cases obviously support our position. The other thing that I think is important to realize is this. The state's going to get up and say, look, there's no way you can have the legislature do all this work because, frankly, they're just too busy. I don't agree with that. And I don't agree with the notion either that it can be just some type of flexibility. If you're going to take away potentially the liberty of somebody, at least give them the common decency, which I think is required by the Constitution, to debate the elements of the crime. And we're deciding in a civilized society what acts and omissions are punishable by a loss of liberty. I think it's worthwhile to consider this, which was quoted by Justice Brandeis in the Olmstead case. Quote, experience should teach us to be most on guard to protect liberty when the government's purposes are beneficent. Men born to freedom are naturally alert to repel invasion of the liberty by evil-minded rulers. The greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachments by men of zeal, well-meaning, but without understanding. That's exactly what we have here. My clients are not saying somehow that there's a conspiracy against them. They're not saying that the legislature is bad. They're just basically saying, you're doing a lot of administrative delegating here. You're just making a mistake as it relates to the creation of crime. There just have to be some things that you can't delegate. And the fact that you create a crime that somebody could lose their liberty should be one of them. Number one, the statute, 22.1.8, says that the acts or omissions have to be defined by the statute. Number two, the South Dakota Constitution is expressed, and as a result, we have to interpret it a little bit differently than the implied powers under the federal government. Number three, I think that it's extraordinarily important to consider the fact that the Boe versus Foss case, which has been on the books for 47 years, says that essential powers cannot be delegated. Now, these GFP rules were created subsequently. Essential powers are things such as defining what the acts or omissions are for a particular criminal statute.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying in no circumstance can an agency define a crime.
That's exactly what I think.
Any crime has to be passed by the law.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can create another example. And this one actually has been approved by the federal United States, by their federal courts. And I totally think it's wrong, and I think that this court should ignore all federal law in this area because, frankly, they're totally abdicating their responsibility. In a state such as ours, we cannot afford to be governed by a bureaucracy. What if the legislature said, it's just too difficult to think of the elements of crimes as it relates to what would constitute malicious parts of a crime for purposes of determining whether or not capital punishment should be imposed? And they say, we're going to leave that up to the Attorney General's office. Totally. The United States Supreme Court said one time, that's okay. That should not be okay. The citizens should be able to decide that. The citizens are represented by the legislature. That is the body that should be debating this, not behind doors so that some bureaucratic government can actually create it. Now, I know that we have some interim meetings that these things are reviewed, but it's not all of the legislative body. It's not. It's not a debate. It shouldn't be that way.
How many crimes are defined? Do you have any idea what the impact would be if we were to decide, as you were suggesting? How many agencies define crimes?
There are lots. The Department of Revenue does. The Department of Health, I think, in some cases. I tried to go through the other administrative rules and look. I found a lot of them, but I can't state with any certainty. To be very honest, this is Justice Cardozo in the Schechter-Poultry case saying, quote, this is delegation running high. It truly is. If I can't
state. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you very much. Every state basically has the same parameters that you're talking about. and you have a permission of delegation, and they say if you're going to delegate, you have to give proper description. There are several states which have ruled directly on point, and they're cited in my brief. The best one that I could find is a case out of the state of Louisiana, and it was actually hunting alligators. And in that case, they said, you cannot have an administrative body for the state of Louisiana defining the elements of when and how you should be punished for taking game alligators out of season. That case is directly on point. Now, I think the state has disagreed with that, but you read that case very closely, it relies upon a Louisiana Supreme Court case called Boone. In that case, they say absolutely directly that they cannot, under the Louisiana Constitution, delegate the authority to create the elements of the crime.
Louisiana,
I found two other state cases, too, by the way, and they're both cited in my brief, and I believe that one of them is out of Kansas, and the other one is out of Ohio. There are two other states which have actually reached this, and one of them was the Department of Revenue case. They said, no, you cannot have the Department of Revenue create the elements of the crime. I can't remember the facts of the other one. But the point is, other places have reached the same decision. Now, I encourage the court to ignore all federal case law on this. Separation of powers doctrine is not an incorporation. It does not flow through the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. They have their own structure, we have our own structure. The only other thing that I would like to address, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We'll allow you to stand in brief on the rest of the issues, and we'll be back for 10 minutes as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hosmer. Mr. Mayor, sir, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbert. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bob Mayer. I'm a Deputy Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. Also on the brief and with me is Craig Eichstead, Deputy Attorney General as well, but I'll be presenting the state's argument in this case. What I'd like to do is to try to quickly go over some of the facts that pertain to these particular convictions and kind of give the court a flavor of what we're dealing with. At first blush, this may appear to be a hunting case. Point of phrase from one of the conservation officers, this isn't about hunting at all, it's about stopping a beating heart. These folks were hunting guides, and they held themselves out as commercial hunting guides. They knew the rules, and they knew the law. Yet, in conservation officer Jeff Grendler's 8 years stationed in Minor County, use of marine band radios to not only enhance their ability to stop these beating hearts, but also to avoid law enforcement, was commonplace. They would communicate with each other, and they would warn each other when Officer Grendler showed up. They would say, and to the students in the audience, I apologize, but they would transmit over the radio, here comes the shit spreader, or here comes the shit wagon. That's how they referred to law enforcement. Also, at one point in the record in front of the jury, we brought out that if Officer Grendler was to stop and search or do a license check for any of the hunters, Bill Moschel instructed over the radio to just flip him off and keep going. Hunting in parties of over 20 was commonplace during these 8 years, using vehicles to run to fields and surround the field and keep the deer in the field was commonplace. And like I said, because of the radios, this thwarted Officer Grendler and gave Fish and Park's ability to catch up to these fellows. So they decided to take another measure, and they initiated an undercover investigation. They entered into agreements with the state of Iowa to hire two of their officers to come here and infiltrate their hunting operation and act as hunters. This they did, and they first had contact with the Michelles on November 16th, 1999. Not much took place during this initial contact, but Bill Moschel, and I use first names, and I don't mean to condescend or make light of the Michelles. We have a Bill and a Dennis, and it's just easy to keep track. Bill tells the undercover officers to come back the last day of the hunting season and join what he called the big group hunt, specifically the big group hunt. So they return on December 17th, 1999 for that pheasant hunt. The officers observed Bill and the rest partaking in ongoing radio discussions about how they're going to hunt the field and box the pheasants in. Between one of these hunts, Bill remarks to the officers that they would be shooting any flying coyotes, and later explains that flying coyotes were hawks, owls, and any other raptors. That's about all that happens on December 17th. They're back the next day, December 18th, and they gather between 11 o'clock and noon to plan the first pheasant hunt. Bill directs things in his yard. He divides the hunters into a paying group and a friends group. The paying group had 27 hunters, seven over the limit, and Bill goes with the paying group to the first hunt. Along the way, he receives a radio message from his son Rodney that there are two roosters within shotgun range in the west side of the ditch. So Bill pulls his Suburban into the left-hand lane, has his passenger Palmer take the wheel, sticks his shotgun out the window, and tries to kill these two pheasants, although I believe that he was unsuccessful. They eventually hunt the field they called the Rock Pile. In that hunt, the group had swelled to 31 hunters, and the final hunt of that day was at Foose, a section of land they referred to as Foose, and again, the number of hunters there was 31. After that hunt was over, the officers observed Bill bring a hen pheasant to his Suburban, and he stuffs it underneath the driver's seat of the truck.
How many of these crimes were cited to administrative rule as opposed to legislative act?
I don't have any issue with Mr. Hosmer's number. I didn't parse that out before the argument, but I don't think it's certainly a great majority. Back at the shop on this particular day, defendant Gene Smith is carrying a hen pheasant, and Bill tells him, hey, here's my hen pheasant, and hands the hen pheasant to Gene Smith. I may refer to him as Butch. This has been a long case, and there's some new things that we're familiar with. But in any event, hands that hen pheasant to Gene Smith, and then Gene Smith takes those hens into the shop to be cleaned. They make arrangements to come back on October 21st, 2000. That's the opening day of pheasant hunting season that day. And on that particular day, Bill again is making the plans, and he divides the group into pay hunters and into friends hunters. And the plan was for the pay group to hunt a field west and south of Bill's house. Interesting plan here, ladies and gentlemen of the court. Bill tells his friends group to go down to the public game production area, the Burke area, but in front of all the public hunters that were waiting there for the season to open and hunt the public land, walk and run and chase the pheasants out of the public land and drive them into the adjoining Foose property, which was private and that Bill was going to hunt later that morning. 26 hunters left in the pay group at that point, and they hunted their first field. When they go to hunt their second field, this is by Highway 25. They start walking, and there's no blockers on this hunt, which was struck the agents as very unusual. Every other hunt had blockers. So they start walking this field, and they get to the middle of the field where there's a rise, and they notice now that the friends group are starting to file in. This is the group that has been to Burke and walking the pheasants out. They now start to arrive and fill in and start blocking for the pay group. And when they meet at the end of the drive, I believe there was 43 hunters. Immediately after that hunt, they then go hunt the Foose land, and pay group starts, I believe, on the west side, walking east, and start on the east side, walking west. Meet at the middle, and when they meet at the middle, there's a fence in the middle of this field, and that's somehow a legal defense or justification for Bill Moschel to send these two parties together, but we would maintain that's a pure fiction. And when they meet, they have 47 hunters. That's about it for that day. The next day, October 22nd, the only thing significant that happens is Bill is get to November, and I'm going to try to hurry through these facts, but I know there's a lot of issues, but the last trip back was in November 2000. The officers wanted to be back there during the deer hunting season and make the big game part of their investigation. So they show up on November 24th, I believe that's the day before, about 1 o'clock, and they go pheasant hunting and observe Dennis take a hen pheasant away from a dog and again stuff it underneath the front seat of Bill's suburban. About 2 o'clock, Bill receives a message on his Marine Band radio that there was a hawk in a tree on the west side of the road, so he looks and finds the hawk, stops the truck, shoots his gun out the window to shoot the hawk, has passenger Jeff Anderson take the wheel. Well, the hawk gets up and it flies from the west side of the road to the east side of the road, foiling Bill's attempt to kill it. So Bill pulls his gun in and drives a quarter of a mile to turn around, turns around and comes back to the hawk to now get a shot at it on the east side of the road. The hawk gets wise. Flies up for the suburban to the west side of the road, and again, Bill can't shoot the hawk. Well, the hawk escapes, and Bill once again is foiled. About 4 p.m., Jeff Anderson spots some pheasants on the west side of the Tarpon Oil, and Bill gets excited and says, let's go get them, and tells Jeff to stick his shotgun out the window. It's near what the Iowans call a field drive. I think what it's up to put into the They take off after the pheasants, Anderson hanging his gun out the window and Bill driving the Suburban. He's chasing these pheasants down in a Suburban on this private land in order to get a shot at him and kill him. I don't think there's any question that the purpose was to get a better shot in order to enhance his ability.
Well, Mr. Mayor, now you've detailed at length some of the activities of the defendant. We're not here to decide whether these defendants are rascals or fine fellows or any other label you want to put on them. We're here solely to decide whether they committed acts which are criminal under South Dakota law. The opposing counsel has said that the state of South Dakota, through its Game and Fish, does not have authority to define crimes. And therefore, whatever they did, the legislature hasn't expressly declared it illegal. What do you have to say to that?
I think it's totally controlled by case law, beginning with Migratory Bird, which is a per curiam opinion, and the defendants conceded the legislative will in this case. Migratory Bird said that SDCL 41-2-18 provided the sufficient guidance or standard to guide the agency.
Did that case address the separation of powers issue?
Well, I think it did in the sense that they set forth what needs to exist in order to delegate, that being, as Justice Center said earlier, the legislative will and then the guidance. Mr. Hogg?
Did it cite the constitutional provision?
No, I've read that case. Mr. Hosmer would make an issue that Migratory Bird is distinguishable because it was a declaratory judgment action and not a charge. Well, that isn't completely true. They were talking about non-toxic, or as we all remember, steel shot shells, and that in fact was made at the time Migratory Bird came down under SDCL 41-1-6. Setting, although the Supreme Court appeal surely wasn't declaratory judgment action. In one case that we cite, kind of right off the bat, it's State versus Lampert, 229 Northwest 622. That's a Wisconsin case from 1975, a chain or a pyramid distribution scheme. It seems like we have the exact same situation. Regulation and delegation was previously found constitutional in a declaratory judgment action by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and then in State versus Lambert, the Wisconsin Supreme Court argument is circular. Migratory bird, I think, submit is absolutely dispositive. Mr. Hosmer cites Lehman versus Southard for the proposition that the general provision can be made and the agency has the power to, quote unquote, fill up the details. Agreed. Wayman was reaffirmed in United States versus Jamad, which again said that they fill up the details by administrative rule, violation of which could be punished by a fine or imprisonment. In other words, it could be criminal. And closer to home, the State versus Hanrahan case that we cited, 267-572. The issue was penned by the Supreme Court at that time, 1978. Was whether the defendant can be convicted of violation of a regulation or whether only acts specifically passed by legislature can be the basis for criminal punishment. That's at 574. The Supreme Court affirmed the conviction and specifically relied upon U.S. versus Ramallah. I think to remove any doubt that this delegation can be done in a criminal setting, Mr. Hosmer touched on it. Case Loving versus United States, which again reaffirms Vermont, and in that case, in fact, it was a death penalty case, and the Supreme Court said it was proper to delegate, I believe it was, to the President's office, as opposed to the Attorney General. It was allowed and proper to delegate the aggravating circumstances of a death penalty case.
Well, those federal cases don't necessarily dispositive of the South Dakota constitutional question?
I don't know if they're dispositive, but I strongly disagree with Mr. Hosmer's suggestion that you ignore all the federal cases. And the reason is because the court has already relied upon, I believe it's the Boulder or Beaver case that Mr. Hosmer cites himself. If I've got the right case.
The thing is, we do have a different way of looking at delegation of authority to an administrative agency and how we review them. We review their decisions differently than the federal government does. So I'm just questioning whether that's something that we're bound by.
I don't know if you're bound by it, but I would just point out that the court has already relied on that line of authority, specifically if I'm correct, is footnote 6 in the Beaver case, the Boulder case. It recognizes Congress' inability to do its job, absent an ability to delegate power. And the court embraced that notion.
It's not true. The federal courts in the United States have historically been much more loose on the law and delegations than the South Dakota.
I think that's true. I don't have any authority, but I wouldn't disagree with that. I think it's just because of the enormity of the size. I think that's set out in the case.
Why can't we ask the legislature to make a determination on a party is okay to form one?
I think you can, and I think that's their prerogative, but I don't think that prohibits them from delegating the authority to fill up the gaps as long as they create the crime, which they did. They set forth in the statute that it's going to be a crime. And as all the case law has said, migratory birds from Bowe v. Frost and from Over, and all the case law that's cited in this issue by both parties support this notion, except for the Johnson case that Mr. Hosmer brought up with you. And that case was about adopting regulations from the federal government or from other states, not our own states, commissions, or agencies, but other states. And the court, in fact, said that's okay. It's just not okay if you're trying to adopt the substance of those regulations that is passed. And I would point out that case is a 1970 case, and since then we've had all of the cases that both Mr. Hoffman and I cite over and to finish on this issue, I disagree with Mr. Hosmer. I just do not see Brother Barker and the rest of the Game Fish and Parks Commission having this enormous power that needs to be explained.
Are they merely filling in the gaps, though, on the indictment charges of violating ARSD rather than SCCL?
Sure. There's no question that the administrative rules provide the elements for the guidance in 41282. The legislature has made that a crime. And the other case that I cite, and this has been approved again, was the old voter inspection sticker case, where the delegation in that case was challenged as unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court affirmed the conviction of the fellow who failed to demonstrate a valid motor vehicle inspection certificate. The court didn't have any problem with the administrative agency filling in the gaps in that case and affirming the conviction. Finally, at the end of my brief, I thought it might be wise to go to some specific game and fish settings, and I did that with the strike. I have 2 minutes, and I can't cover everything I wanted to, but I did want to at least make a few comments on the instruction that Judge Erickson gave about the undercover investigations being offered. Again, at first blush, that might appear to the court to be instruction that is highly unusual and uncalled for, but I want to emphasize that that instruction was invited by the defendants. Judge Erickson found that the defendants were laying the groundwork for nullification of the charges. They were trying to show that the undercover officers, because they were present during these crimes, they may have assisted or at least acquiesced in them, that they should be guilty too and that should be a defense. Judge Erickson specifically found that that was nullification. He wasn't going to stand for it. He wasn't going to allow it. And that it was, what did he say? Words that he used was
properly and legally conducted.
What I was looking for, Justice Savers, was particularly egregious as to what defense counsel's conduct amounted to, because they were trying to show behavior by the officers, but they conceded that they could never meet the Supreme Court's standard of officer misconduct or overreaching. Yet they put this issue in front of the jury instead of bringing it to the judge and having a motion in front of the judge outside the presence of the jury to address it, all the while conceding that they could never meet it. I think it's just a general case law, Justice Cohen Camp, given the circumstances that the judges decided in their brief of a wide range of discretion. I haven't either, and that's why I wanted to address this issue, because the defendants brought the issue up that perhaps they were not acting properly by acquiescing and even partaking, for instance, in the over 20 minutes. And it was particularly egregious in this case.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Hosmer, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you very much. If I could, I'd like to respond directly to some of the issues that relate to issues. Let's go directly to the Hanrahan case, because I think I want to clear that up. The Hanrahan case concerning the insertion of an inspection sticker. When you read that case, I looked very closely at it. The holding on paragraph 19 says this: SDCL 32-21-21 clearly prohibits operating a motor vehicle without displaying a valid inspection sticker or a valid rejection sticker. What that simply means is the elements are found in the statute. There was no delegation. So I think that case doesn't stand for the point of the state asserts. As it relates to the migratory board case, read that one very closely. They never reach the issue of whether or not there are some powers which can never be delegated. Read the Bolger case. The Bolger case stands for the position and reaffirms Bo versus Boss versus Bo that there are some
Take, for example, pheasant season. The length of pheasant season depends upon how many pheasants there are. And you don't know sometimes until after the spring or the summer. Of course, that's dependent on whether there's a drought, bad weather. Same with deer hunting. How many licenses are issued, how long the season lasts, all products of various weather conditions. I mean, wouldn't the legislature have to be meeting periodically in order to make these rules?
You bring up a very good point. The only thing I can tell you is it relates to, I'll address specifically in general. Specifically, that doesn't concern any of the administrative rules concerning this case. We're talking about whether you can protrude a gun out a window with what's up. Is that a rabbit? We're looking at whether or not there is cooperation amongst 20 hunters. That doesn't change very quickly. We're looking at how you disturb game by driving a vehicle. And we're looking at whether or not receiving electronics obviously is a violation of communication. So I don't think it pertains here, but you do raise an interesting issue. And the best response I can give to you is this. Our legislature is unique. We have a farm legislature a lot of times. We have a lot of people who can't meet, so they meet during the winter. So as a result, the response is this. GFP goes out and bangs the bushes to find out what the pheasant population is on the last day of the session, bring it in, and improve it. There's nothing wrong with that. That's in March. By then, they'll know. I think that's very simple.
Wouldn't it also be quite normal for the department or the agency to make recommendations as to all of these things instead of like creating the crimes themselves, then proposing them to the legislature and the legislature consider them in a shorter amount of time and just adopt them or reject them?
Absolutely, and I think that's exactly what would happen. You probably have a subcommittee meeting that's an annual meeting for the hunting group, and they'd say, this is our suggestions for the year, no modifications. After the first year, it wouldn't be any really, if you think about what's going on here, I'll tell you a good policy reason to not have this happen. Look at issues 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They're all issues about the interpretation of administrative rules. There's vagueness flying throughout these. There's no definition of cooperation for issue number 5. There's no definition of rodent for issue number 4. There's no proper definition of disturbing for issue number 6. And there's no definition of receiving for issue 3. Look, let's face it. Legislatures have more time, more availability for people to assist them to consider this. The public decides. And what we're having here is administrators creating statutes which are totally different. I look, for example, on the issue of cooperation. The facts clearly indicate that the Moschels were hunting and the other people just showed up and were standing on the road. There's not one bit of evidence that they fired a weapon or were blocking. If you're going to call the fact that 20 people show up on a road, cooperation with 20 people who are walking a field, there's going to be more people convicted of this in South Dakota than you can possibly think of. I've hunted and people have shown up on the road and made us more than 25.
That's a jury question, though, isn't it?
I do believe that is a jury question, but it is a legal question on the definition of cooperation. And in this case, it was broad enough to include that. And I think that was wrong. The same thing pertains to the rodent issue. The statute, the administrative rule, says rodent, but they don't define rodent. So as a result, you have to go to the case or to the actual statutes. Is a cottontail rabbit a rodent? I mean, I can't imagine a more unique issue to that. As far as I can see, if you look in the dictionary, it says it all over the place. A rabbit is a rodent.
I get the point of the dictionary.
Well, I looked at two of them, Collegiate Webster's. I also think, I can't believe I'm debating this issue. 3420-25 also specifically describes the fact that you can't lay poison or rabbits, or rodents, or other rodents. So the legislature has said in that context, rabbits or other rodents. How about disturbing game? If you say that it's okay under these facts for disturbing game, every road hunter in South Dakota is guilty of a violation. Everybody drives up to the game. That's the purpose of road hunting. You can't just say road hunt until you see something, you gotta run. People drive to the pheasants. What happens? I just see all kinds of problems here. And I probably should go on to the final issue, which was addressed by the state as it relates to issue number 9. We clearly think that this is improper for the judge in this case. The trial court, in its own initiation, wholly created and then read their following instruction. The South Dakota Constitution, Article 6, Section 6, says that my clients are guaranteed a fair policy decision. I can't, that's a debatable proposition on whether or not undercover agents are necessary. The next one, proper and legal. Reasonable people can agree or disagree on that proposition. It is clear that the assertion by the trial court was ineffective, it bolstered the state's witnesses, the undercover agent. The state's arguing this is insane by me. Boy, that is really giving a disservice to the citizens who sent on that jury. They had to have known who the undercover agents were. They both testified for 2 days. They were subject to cross-examination and referred to as paid agents, covert agents, undercover agents. And just imagine what would have happened if the judge would have instructed that my clients, Bill, Dennis, and Jean, were acting properly and legally. I can only imagine that that would be instructable for them too. Let's have a fair, equal opportunity to present this to the jury. Now, I think that this is actual a presumption of prejudice. Look at the Golden Brothers, which is the United States Supreme Court case, in the brief. Quote, jurors are ever watchful of the words that fall from the judge, from him, the judge. Particularly in a criminal trial, the judge's last word is apt to be the decisive word. I'm requesting this particular court to look back and be satisfied with the judges. This is totally out of order. This was not an open-the-door situation. When there is an actual quotation by the judge in this case, he says, they open the door. They are the ones who brought this upon them. Find it in the quotes. It's not there. This was zealous representation by Wilson Highbacker and Indiana. They zealously represented, but they didn't make any arguments which were improper. They didn't make any references to anything that wasn't contained in the evidence. The judge did this in his own initiative. My client should have the service of not having that instruction. All of these charges. The presumption. It's simply a he said, she said case. My clients gave evidence which would have exonerated. It came down to credibility 100%. They had no slugs, they had no carcasses. It was what they said versus my client's witnesses. And when the judge puts one thumb on the scales of justice and says they're proper, legal, and necessary, what's a jury to do? They can't say that all the rest of the instructions appear to be false. Because of the United States Supreme Court case in Worship, where they said, that's not going to work. It's not going to work. You can't have an instruction that says that you're the judges of credibility, but then tell them that the other people are acting proper and necessary. As a result, issue number 9 should invalidate all of the convictions. All of them. You combine 1 and 9 together, 15 of the 27 charges were thrown out, the other 12 were reversed for a new trial. And that's a constructively whatever.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs.
Thank you very much.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.